pretty good.
Okay, I guess afternoon session is almost arriving. Ron Chisholm is with us. So, floor is yours.
It's fine. Very good. Thank you.
Probably you want to have a little bit different way so the people.
I think I'll turn that a bit like that. So, Father, do you have a light?
I will find out.
I'm just wondering if you're allowed to smoke in here.
We don't have a detector. You can pretend.
We can pretend. But my question is, if you gave me a light, I mean, everybody sits there and they think, what's the matter with this guy? Doesn't he know these things can kill him? So if you gave me a light, are you, like, assisting my death?
I don't know.
I mean, come on. No. Somebody gets a Snickers bar and they're a diabetic. Are you helping them along? There's an awful lot of things that we can do in our lives that are going to bring us, that can kill us. And I think Sister Nuala Kenny said some people go out and they bungee jump. And other people take these crazy risks. But we all do things in our lives that are going to bring us around to that death thing. And the one thing about humans that's unique among all animals, we're the only animal on earth that considers our death. We're the only ones that are aware of our death. It's uniquely human for people to consider death. And that's really what the story of the Garden of Eden was about, is that these people became conscious of their aware of themselves, aware of their birth, aware of their death, and of the time in between their birth and death, all that stuff. It's uniquely human to think about your death and to consider how you're going to live your life between your birth and death, and then how you're going to die. And I think it's extremely important that we not forget exactly how we got to where we are today. Right now, people in the room are appalled, certainly by Bill C-14. There are changes that are happening in our society and in our medical science that we never had to deal with before. It was never an issue as to what you would do. When somebody got old, they just got old and died. That was it. But now life goes on, and there's means of keeping people alive into their hundreds and past. And it's a difficult life choice and decision, and it's difficult for Christians to know, well, as a Christian and as a Catholic, how do I manage these changes? And it's really important that we look at how we got to where we are today so that we're looking at a bill like C-14. If you go all the way back to like the 1750s and 1800s, the Enlightenment, and you deal with all of the introduction of science like Newton and Charles Darwin and all the political philosophers that came out, there's a whole pile of unrest that got unleashed with the Enlightenment, or the Age of Reason, as they call it. And you end up with having the American Revolution, the French Revolution. You've got Darwin talking about the survival of the fittest and the, you know, the strong over the weak. You've got science unleashing itself, people moving. And because of the ideas of the Enlightenment, you see industrialization of the world. You see all these agrarian farming communities where people are getting dragged into the cities, these teeming cities. You have factories that are full of the masses of people that were impoverished, that there was prostitution, there was alcoholism, there was just abuse of the individual. Anybody who's in this room that's Scottish, unless you came recently, you were expelled from the Highlands or from Scotland. And that was to put sheep on, so that factories could make wool and they could have factories. So you have these sweatshops, and Charles Dickens, he wrote all the books like Oliver Twist and these other ones about the conditions that people lived in during that time period. And it was really interesting because Pope, I think it was Leo XIII, he did an encyclical called Rerum Novarum, which is about in labor against the system against the individual. And this was back in 1893. And it was really interesting to see how our faith and our church was struggling with these changes that were unleashed by the Enlightenment. And I'm just going to read you the third paragraph from that encyclical from 1893. So Pope Leo XIII said, "In any case, We clearly see that some remedy must be found quickly for the misery and the wretchedness pressing so unjustly on the majority of the working class. For the ancient working men's guilds were abolished in the last century, and no other protective organizations took their place. Public institutions and the laws set aside the ancient religion. Hence, by degrees, it has come to pass that working men have been surrendered, isolated, and helpless to the hard-heartedness of employers and the greed of unchecked competition. The mischief has been increased by the rapacious usury, which, although more than once condemned by the church, is nevertheless under a different guise still practiced by covetous, grasping men. To this must be added that the hiring of labor and the conduct of trade are concentrated in the hands of a comparatively few, so that a small number of very rich people have been able to lay upon the teeming masses of the laboring poor a yoke little better than that of slavery itself. So this is 1893. And you're seeing the effect that the Enlightenment has had on unleashing science and unleashing technology, new ways of thinking, the overturning of the old ways. And then throughout the 20th century, we can't forget the horrors of the 20th century. People trying to figure out how to address this problem that the Pope has put forward, but they were all experiencing. The Pope didn't make this up. He just enunciated what he was seeing, that everybody was seeing. And so Karl Marx, a man of the Enlightenment, came forward and he said, well, look, the people are enslaved by capital or capitalists. So wouldn't it be smart just to enslave capital to the people? And that's what his solution was. The people would own everything. The people would get the benefit of whatever capital could do. So communism got underway. And in the Soviet Union, 20 million people were killed under Joseph Stalin. You go to the Mao China, and you've got tens of millions of people killed there. In other parts of Europe, they tried to deal with how to address the problems of the individual, and you've got the fascists that came forward. You've got Mussolini in Italy, you've got Franco in Spain, and of course you had Adolf Hitler in Germany. And non-combatants in Germany, in 10 years, they killed between 11 and 12 million non-combatants. That's not the veterans, the people, you know, the people that went to war to fight and they got bombed and shot. These are people that were innocents, that were slaughtered by this. And the reason why is that in all of these states, whether it's communism or whether it's fascism or a dictatorship, it's always the interest of the state that takes priority over the individual. There's only been one system of government that has ever put the individual first, and that's democracy. And democracy has had this unbelievable revelation. And the revelation is that there is a spark of the divine in every single individual. Everybody is to be treated equal. It doesn't matter if you're a very rich person versus a very poor person, a person with disability, a marginalized, disenfranchised, unlikable, dislikable person that nobody wants around. It doesn't matter. That person has the spark of the divine within them. Now this is revolutionary because it's completely contrary to the laws of nature. Charles Darwin will tell you it's the powerful over the weak. It's the strong will survive, the weak will die. Those systems of government, fascism, communism, when you put all that concentrated power in the hands of a very few unaccountable people, result in the destruction of the human spirit. We have an obligation as Catholics and Christians in a democracy to ensure that this revolutionary concept is not forgotten, that we recognize that we have a system of government that's cost hundreds of millions of lives, that's taken a century of horrors to come to the point where democracy and the freedom and the intrinsic worth of the individual are upheld in constitutions and in charters. So it was only after the Second World War that the United Nations and some of the great thinkers put together the UN Charter of Human Rights, that the human, the individual, has priority over every state, and any state could not overrule the interests of these people, simply put in place because of the horrors of communism and the horrors of fascism and the horrors of dictatorships. So that gets us around to where we are today, which is we've got a government that is looking at assisting us on the way out the door. Whenever you've got a government that's taking a real interest in your death, you should sit up and take notice. And that's exactly where we are today, is that we've got a situation with Bill C-14. It came out of a decision in Quebec. And Sister Nuala Kenny made a comment that was really interesting. Said it was 2015 that the law was overruled. Like in the criminal code, assisted suicide was previously prohibited under the criminal code as a form of culpable homicide. And the prohibition was overturned in February of 2015, and in June 2016, the Bill C-14 was passed. So it took very little time for governments to hop right on this and make the change. But the change that they did make, it put in a great number of safeguards, and I think it's important that I review them, because I'm going to make a prediction that we're going to watch over the next couple of years these safeguards steadily get eroded away. The safeguards were put in place primarily to assuage the conscience of those people that were worried about getting involved in the end-of-life decision-making and taking away the spark of the divine from somebody because they're really a burden. You're going to see that. But here under Bill C-14 are the protections that are in place. It's not available to minors, nor on the grounds of mental illness or long-term disability or any curable condition. You have to be eligible for Canadian health care coverage, and that's to prevent suicide tourism. I've had some bad vacations, but I've never considered suicide as a good option on my trip. But apparently suicide tourism was a concern the government had. Patients cannot arrange consent in advance to dying later at the hands of a caregiver as dementia. So you can't say, okay, here I am today, 59. If I ever get dementia to a certain extent, then I want you to knock me out and get rid of me. You can't say that. You can't say that right now. There's got to be informed consent just prior to the event, and it must be repeatedly expressed, not implied, including right before the moment of death. As Sister Nuala Kenny said, they come in and say, right before death, are you okay with this? Is this what you want? If they confirm it, then away you go. And consent can be revoked at any time. To qualify, a patient has to be experiencing intolerable suffering and sign a consent in front of two witnesses 10 clear days before the date of death. They also have to be, it's got to be a terminal illness, and two physicians or a nurse practitioner must independently confirm the written agreement that the patient has an incurable, grievous, and irreversible medical condition that is an advanced state of irreversible decline, and the patient's natural death is reasonably foreseeable, and the patient is capable and willing to receive medically assisted death. So these safeguards were entirely put in place because of the good work of Sister Dr. Kenny and other groups that were there that said, look, this is a very dangerous, slippery place that you're going to. So if you're insisting upon doing this, which we disagree with, but if you are, then we need to see these precautions put in place. Well, already, if you were watching CBC News just 2 weeks ago out of Quebec, again, another decision's come forward that says, look, you don't have to be terminally ill. Now you can just be disabled. And obviously the concern is that there's a lot of people, if you've got the spark of the divine in everybody, there it's in the disabled as well as the abled. It's in everybody. It's not a question of whether a person is severely disabled, because the distinction is, as a Catholic, it's death is a natural result of our life. As Christians, we believe in the resurrection. We believe that death is not the end. We're not scared of death. People are really scared of suffering, though. Nobody really wants to suffer, and nobody wants their loved ones to suffer. So you end up by having this conflict within the person saying, well, you know, I wouldn't let my dog suffer. So why would I let my dear mother suffer or somebody else? But then again, it becomes a point where you have to be careful, because we as Christians understand that our life was given to us as a free gift, a gift from God. And it was a gift from God that we were given our free will. And the greatest gift that we can give back to God is for us to submit our free will to God. That is the gift. That is what Sister was talking about when you see Christ in Gethsemane when he was praying, or when during the desert after he starved himself and he was tempted. It is that human urge not to submit your will to God. In fact, the prayer that Christ had right in the garden was, God, if you could, you know, Father, if you could take this cup from me, you know, but not my will be done, your will be done. That's the Our Father. Thy will be done. It's the submission of our will to the will of our Father, our Heavenly Father. That is the nature of the greatest gift that we can give back to God. He gave us life. God gave us free will. For us to give our free will back to God is our gift that makes us acceptable to God. And so when we look at the bill that's out there right now, it's one that it's being used, and I suspect it's going to be used more. I think there's a really telling comment that Dr. Sister Kenny made, which is that about the woman who is Catholic, that her son said, oh, don't worry, Mom, we don't like to see you suffer like this. You know, there is assisted death out there. You're free to go if you want. You know, like the grief that would cause, and then all of a sudden the concern the mother had that she was causing grief and suffering to her own children. The attitudes can change very quickly. And as the 20th century has shown, governments are not respecters of human life. Governments aren't human. Governments are regulated by laws, and they act according to laws. And the minute that this spark of the divine concept starts to get eroded away from governments is the minute you have to be really cautious. And you see a situation where the governments are saying, well, those darn baby boomers, they're great for paying taxes. But now all of a sudden we've got this huge bubble of people coming through, and we've got these got these ways to keep people alive for generations and hundreds of years. And, you know, all of a sudden it can become something the governments actively promote, because it's in their economic self-interest to try to wean off the people that are in the system that are not contributing to the government anymore. They're not contributing to the GDP of the country. They're people that are a burden. And, you know, there's an interest in them to see to it that their tax dollars are put in other places and not in maintaining the lives of people that are going to die anyways. That's really where the line has to be drawn, I think. And I think we will see in the next number of years the constant erosion of those safeguards as because the government can see. I mean, I'll bet that the language that will be used is that, look, this may not be for everybody, but, you know, you may want to consider this. And it'll put it in a very agreeable and a very acceptable and a very sort of forward-looking way that you're being helpful. You're not letting others, you know, carry the burden of your weight. You'll be made to think about this long in advance of your death, and a lot of people are going to consider that maybe getting rid of my own life is probably the best option. Always keep in mind the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. And that applies to us, that applies to everybody. And because it goes to the root of that gift that is our life. So there's some considerations there. So what we do right now in the law practice is the personal care directive, is the directive that the doctors need in order to know what your end of life decisions are. And in it, you appoint a person that you've deemed to be appropriate, that knows your end-of-life wishes, typically a family member or close person to you. And at there's a portion of that, and I'm just going to read it out right now, that says, without limiting my delegate's authority, if at any time I have a physical illness from which there is little likelihood of recovery, and it's so serious that my life is nearing its end, my mental functions become permanently impaired with no likelihood of improvement, and the impairment is so severe that I do not understand what is happening to me, and my physical condition means that medical treatment would be needed to keep me alive. So you're in pretty bad shape at this point. Or if I become permanently unconscious with no likelihood of regaining consciousness, I express the wish that I not be kept alive by medical treatment. Instead, I wish medical treatment be limited to keeping me comfortable and free of pain. I confirm these provisions are intended by me to be an expression of my informed wishes. So, as Dr. Sister Kenny said, you're not, there's, the Catholic Church throughout its history has worked at alleviating suffering. It's started hospitals, it's orphanages, it's done everything in its power, and suffering is not the end goal. Any alleviation of suffering that we can do is good. If people need pain medication, they get as much as they need in order to live as pain-free. It's not the suffering that is a good thing. It's obviously a very bad thing. If people can avoid it, we should try to help them avoid it. But at the end, death is not something to be feared. It is something to be accepted. So these are the provisions, and those are the rules, as I understand, that palliative care. Like, their job is to keep you as comfortable as possible and to help you as much as possible and to ensure that you have as much time as needed. So those are the provisions of the Personal Care Directive. Typically, as was noted earlier, you can't specifically guess as to what the circumstances are going to be that are going to lead to your end, that you need to trust the person that you've put in charge of giving directions to your doctors. And if you do, and if they know your wishes and they know your faith and they understand how you wish to live your life, and if you've lived your life according to that up until the date of death, you don't want to change the last week or so of your life, you want to live a certain way, then that person is the one that can direct the doctors as to how they're supposed to behave. So my only consideration is that when the government offers to light your cigarette for you, you better be very careful. Just take a second look and wonder if they're really trying to help you out or who they're trying to help. So it's it's an area of law that's changing. And it's changing fast, and it's a very difficult area because many people suffer along with the person who's dying. Many people are really stretched, but nobody ever said life was going to be easy. Nobody ever said that we're supposed to have a free ride, and just as Sister Kenny said, you know, just because you pray, then God will bless you, and then you pray, you know, things don't go right. Life is suffering, and I love the picture that she had of Christ at Gethsemane, because he was suffering, and the agony in the garden was beyond the pale of anything that any one of us could probably imagine, and yet he did that for us, and we're all called to suffer. Christ didn't come to protect us from suffering. He came to help guide us through it and through to the other side. So those are my considerations. If there are any questions, I'm certainly open to questions. And yes?
If you write yourself a personal directive, is it legal? Do you have to go through a lawyer to do that?
Well, as long as it's witnessed by two independent witnesses and the witnesses' signatures are sworn, then it's legal. So it's difficult to find folks that can actually swear your signature, but if you know commissioners of oaths and you've got two independent witnesses, then you can certainly do your own.
And that paper that you just read from?
Yes.
Is that available for people? Yeah, we'd all like to copy that.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet you would. You come to my office. Yeah, bring a debit card. It's actually generally available. It's not, you can, there's a pre-printed form, and I think if you just go online, you can go to Personal Care Directive, and you can print one off. And well, I'll give you the site if you'd like. I'll give you the site that you can go to. And I just have to be careful about from a legal perspective, if I've got my documents out there and somebody uses them or abuses them, and then I could get dragged into, you know, what, how did this happen? Why are you using your, so I'll give you a pre-printed form that you can use that's not mine.
You can get the personal care directive through continuing care as well.
Through continuing care, absolutely. So it's something that the hospitals are actively promoting and they really need it, because these decisions have to be made, and it's very difficult. I know there's my mother had seven children, and she was in the hospital, and they didn't know what was the matter with her, but she was dying, and the doctors called us all together and said, look, not much we can do. Do you want us to send her to Halifax? It would entail putting her in a helicopter. It's pretty expensive, and flying her to the city. So there's quite a debate among the children. Some people said, look, don't make mom suffer anymore. Others said, look, we need to have the diagnosis. So we put her in the helicopter, and she went to Halifax, and she recovered and lived 10 full good years. It was great. But, I mean, there was that debate. There was that moment in time where we were there, and we didn't. It could have gone either way. We didn't have a personal care directive then.
So anything that you signed while being in hospital to that, you know, I guess they used the term call it living well, and then they put it on your body, so that is no more...
Yeah, they don't want the living wills as much anymore. In fact, they want a personal care directive, because that's the legislation that was passed. Like in 2010, they passed legislation that said that the hospitals are to respond to a personal care directive. And a living will, as Sister Kenny had noted, people put all kinds of provisions in there. If this happens, then that. And the doctors don't abide by that. And there's no legislative... There's no legislative authority for the doctors to comply with that. They will comply with the legislative authority of a personal care directive, because in my case with our family, if the doctors took the advice of one group and the other group was very unhappy with it, they could go sue the doctor, because he said, you didn't take our instructions. He said, well, I took the instructions of those three over there. And he said, well, there's four of us and three of them, so you should have gone with us. You know, that's the kind of situation that you don't know. And so they have to go with the person, the testator or the person that's done the document points and says, I want you to be my, that is my personal care director person. And that way they've got the legal authority.
Yeah, because when my husband was dying, they called me up one night and they said, you know, he can't speak for himself, so his spouse told me, you have to tell us what you want. So it wasn't even written.
Yeah. Indicated that when her husband passed away, that she just got a call from the hospital. They didn't have a personal care directive. They just said, look, you're his spouse, so what do we do? And so do we keep him on support or not? And apparently not. Yes. Intubate him. Yeah, they were done. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's the other difficult decision. It's a very, very difficult area. You can't come to this meeting today and come back with a black and white response to what's going to happen, because it's not that way. People in the old days that might have had a stroke would have likely died. But through heroic efforts and all sorts of technology, they don't die. But they're not back to where they were by a long shot. Some people are in really difficult circumstances. So it's the intervention into nature and the involvement all the way through of technology that's creating this, not a Frankenstein, but certainly creating a circumstance that is challenging our ability to sort of have clear answers. And it's it forces us to think about the underlying values that you live your life by in order to comply with those values when you're at end of life decision making. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If a person had a personal care directive and it's possible when it's on your record, it would become a permanent part of your record, I assume. Get well, go home, come back 5 years later. There's no one around.
Yeah, well, it's legal.
And
until you revoke it or change it, it's what's there.
But they want to see it every time you go in. Yeah. So my husband, like, anytime he went by ambulance, that was the first thing I was asked for. And I said, it's on your on his records here. No, we have to see it again.
Yeah. They just want to make sure that, yeah, there's no change.
My understanding of a living will includes a whole bunch of things, like not just the dead, but once you get into mental conditions that you can no longer function yourself, then you pass that on to someone else to make those decisions. From what I'm hearing from you, that is not allowed anymore?
Yeah, that's a good point. There is a clear distinction between a power of attorney, where you give your authority to make decisions related to your finances and your day-to-day living, non-medical issues. That's a power of attorney, and if you've granted that to somebody, they've got that authority. A medical consent or a personal directive deals entirely and only with your healthcare decisions. So it only deals with decisions related to the medications and the treatments that you might or might not be getting. So there's quite a distinction. Yes? Pardon? Yeah, two documents are required. That's right. Yes, sir.
Say you had a bad holiday, like you were talking about. should you be carrying a personal declaration with you on holiday?
Somebody who cares for you should have one. If you've got family at home, or if you've got somebody that's got access to your files, they'd probably be required to, you know, if you're traveling with your spouse and you don't have it with you, you'd have to be able to get it. But fortunately, you can typically email and scan and send or courier documents now. So, but yeah, it's a good point. I don't know if you'd have to travel with it all the time, but you should have access to it. Yeah.
Ron.
Yes.
That begs the question. A declaration is signed here and authorized here, will other governments in other countries respect that and abide by it?
Yeah, normally they will. Depends. There's a lot of different countries in the world, but certainly any British Commonwealth country, if it's been signed and sealed, and it gets complicated because it involves your insurance company and where your contract of insurance was signed. So if you're dealing with healthcare insurance and you're under the Nova Scotia government, and you get sick in Florida or someplace else, they're going to treat you there, but they're going to try to get you back home. So if you're from Nova Scotia and that's where your health coverage is from, then that personal care directive is valid. If you're, you know, if in other circumstances, it might not be. If you're traveling in with no health care insurance, I don't know what would happen. But
so if you did have that, regardless of insurance, would they be obliged to look at that and abide by your wishes in terms of how you should be treated, either with or without medications, when you can't speak for yourself?
That would depend upon the laws of the country that you're in. So if you were in, Mozambique, yeah, maybe not. If you're in the United States, it definitely would, because they're concerned about the legal ramifications of giving treatment to somebody and whether they've got legal authority to do it or not. So they would rely upon it because their legal system and ours are pretty in sync. Yeah. Yes?
If you name your spouse as your personal care director, and if they die before you do, do you have to make a whole new thing? Or would it be... can you name a second?
Yep, you can name a second. In the alternative, if they're unable or unwilling to so act, then I appoint. Yeah, that's good.
May I ask another question? If you don't have a director, that person's not available, but your directive is, doesn't that speak for you? The written directive?
Yeah, the written directive that you've got there, it certainly would be an indication of your intent and your will. Not to be kept alive and to continue on. You're referring to the last paragraph that I read, you know, that if I'm not to do any extraordinary efforts, yeah, that would certainly speak for you, for sure. Yes, sir.
Just a follow-up again, the travel question. Let's say you've got Blue Cross, either blanket coverage ongoing for travel, or you buy a one-off. Is there the opportunity to register a personal care directive with the insurance provider?
They wouldn't be that interested in your personal care directive. Since they're essentially paying the bills, they don't really care what, or I should say they don't care what treatments you get, but they're not the decision maker on the treatments that you're going to get. So it would really have to be, as I said, with you or somebody traveling with you, or that you could convey that to, somebody could convey it on your behalf. But the Blue Cross itself, they wouldn't be interested in that. No. Yes, Elder.
Ron, can you speak to what happens if you land in hospital and you do not have a personal care directive, or you don't have anyone making decisions for you? What happens then?
Yeah. So that's sort of the Jane or the John Doe situation, where people land in hospitals and it happens enough that they can't contact, or they don't know who their next of kin are, and then they just treat them as well as they can, and at some point they don't know what to do either. So it's a scenario that they don't want to be left in. That's why they're insisting upon personal care directives. But when they do get those situations, in Canada for sure, you'll get treated. In the United States, you get shown the door, typically. Not always, unless the person has good insurance, but I mean, that's, or they'll go to a public hospital. But they will give general treatments, but whether they'll do extraordinary efforts to keep a person alive or to continue them on, that's very questionable. They would have a role, but the public trustee is probably one of the slowest moving creatures known to humanity. I mean, you send letters to them, and maybe in 3 months' time you might get something back. And unless, of course, there's a big pile of cash sitting there and some old person dies and they've been a miser and there's $1 million, then the public trustee parachutes in. Other than that, you don't see them, you know, they're not interested in a lot of stuff. So you're right, they would become involved at some point, but what would happen would be the social workers and other people would be called in, and then they would have to get a hold of the public trustee, and then they'd have to try to determine if they have any assets at all, and if they don't, then they would do some work, just enough to get it through the system. But that's normally way down the road. In fact, I did have a case like that. There was it was interesting that this old gentleman was in his 80s. He came in and his wife was getting on. They never got along anyways, but she was getting, her memory was going, and she was very cranky. He was always yelling. So he finally had a little suitcase by the door because he had a bad heart. So one day he just picked the suitcase up and walked over to his niece's house in Truro. He came from Halifax. And so then his wife died about a year later, and turns out that there was a safe deposit box, and it was absolutely stuffed full of King George money, you know, like from way back in the Prohibition years. And it turns out that her family were bootleggers in Halifax. Whenever the British warships would show up, they'd row out in the rowboats, and they'd offload all the liquor, and then they would take it and they'd bootleg it and then hide the money, and she inherited all this money. I think she inherited either that or she was a bootlegger, I don't know. But it was really old money. So they opened up this box and it just popped out with money. It was just crazy. So anyway, the public trustee, that's what I said about parachuting it in, they were all over us. They claimed the money for themselves, and yeah. But anyway, we worked it out. It worked out well. But it was, yeah, that was the only time I've ever seen them move fast at all. Yeah. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I was just thinking, when you sign organ donation, so there's a registry for organs that exists.
Yes.
So nothing that exists, like you don't have to go, you just want to have people know what the person's trigger is, so there's no type of system set up
with Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the personal care directive. But no, for the organ donations, I believe the law has just changed that unless you opt out of it on your license, you will be donating your organs unless you're really old. If they're interested in your organs, they'll take them. But other than that, but there's nothing like that. Yeah. If you, some people, I don't know if they could find a heart in them anyway. So. Which one? The
one where they just put in place for the center and they take your order from.
Yeah. The that'd be a really good question for Father Darius. I don't know if I could answer that one.
As a Christian lawyer, what would you say?
He said, is it just or unjust, an unjust law, that the government can actually take your organs when you're dead, whether you've signed off on it or not? And the tipping point is that you had an option to sign your license saying, don't do that. But if you didn't do that, like it's a double negative here, then they will do it. So you have to actually take affirmative action to say, don't do it. Then they're going to assume that you did do it. And that's it's a good question because it's a reverse onus, and almost always reverse onuses are not constitutional.
And there's been precedents that hasn't been permitted by the law.
Yes. I think the law could be challenged, but there doesn't seem to be any kind of a movement afoot right now to challenge it. So. It's until it's challenged, it is the law. But I agree with you. I think you've got a good argument there. Like it's a reverse onus, and they're typically not legal. So constitutionally,
when is that going to happen?
Oh, that was put in place a year ago. Things happen. Yeah.
So if you never sign, then they can't
cut you. Wrong. If you didn't sign to be an organ donor, you are one. That's okay. Unless you have to mark in your license that you don't want to be an organ donor. You better check that.
What if people don't have a license? You know, like...
I don't know. I never looked into that. There was a question back there.
That was...
Yeah, I don't know. I know that typically in order for a person's organs to be of any value at all, you have to be a relatively young person and you have to be not brain dead. Yeah, well, virtually dead, but still body functioning. So, and that's almost entirely motorcycle accidents and car accidents, but motorcycles are the greatest source of, they call them donor cycles. So that's where they get them all from. That's why they want them, because they're all young men that are in good shape otherwise, and they're gone. So, any other questions?
How am I supposed to know whether I did or I didn't?
I don't know.
You
make an appointment with my office, and I'll. Yeah. I think it's when it's up for renewal. There's a provision there. Yeah. So, I don't think there's any other. Oh, there are questions? Nothing? Yes.
Well, it's not a question, it's just a statement. At the time of death, who administers the last dose of the morphine? The doctor or the caregiver?
One or the other. Normally, like morphine is administered in certain doses very carefully, and it's all on the. It's all on the chart, and I'm not a nurse or a doctor, so I don't know exactly, but I do know that they've got death and dying rounds. Like after people die in the hospital, they review what went on, and the charts are reviewed, and a person has to be administered what was prescribed. And if you prescribe, like there's a limit that any human being can withstand, so if it was over prescribed, then that becomes an issue for the doctor. Yes.
Mm-hmm. The doctor told me to do it. Mm-hmm. I also wondered why he didn't do it. For a few months after that, I felt guilty. I have to kill him.
Yeah, but no, you didn't.
I thought that he should have convinced himself to do that.
Yeah, he was probably worried. If it's something that the doctor did not want to be personally responsible for it, and if there's ever any second thoughts afterwards by anybody, then he could be sued. and he'd have his license taken from him. So the consequences for the doctor would be pretty severe from a regulatory point of view. So, yeah, that's why, I think.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
If you have a worker, can the worker speak for you?
They can. They can speak for you, but they can't order or direct any type of treatments. As long as you can speak and you're conscious, you speak for yourself. But otherwise, if you're unconscious, then your worker does not have authority unless you've given it to them to make decisions for your health care.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we're done. Oh.
And I want to, on behalf of the committee, we want to say thank you to Ron.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Ellen.
Hi. As representative of the pastoral care team in our parish, I'd like to thank all of you for being here today and participating in the workshop. In particular, well, thank you to Ron and Sister Nuala as earlier. But this is the advertising portion of the program. Our pastoral care in our parish is, as a number of you who are members of the pastoral care team can attest, it's a volunteer organization, and they reach out to our community in a number of ways. Nursing home visits, nursing home Eucharistic visits, hospital visits, home visits, liturgical word and music visits. There's a group which meets with grief. There's a prayer chain. Now, membership in this group is no cost. Your commitment is about one afternoon, one evening, and it's of your own choosing with whomever you choose to visit. Now, what do you need? The ability to listen. Your care and concern for others will be greatly appreciated and will always be remembered. And that's your commitment. Now, there's the standard stuff of background checks and anytime you're dealing with voluntary or vulnerable people, but that goes with any volunteer organization these days. So, if you feel inclined, get in touch.
So we have 3 hours before 4 o'clock Mass, so it's a good time. So I think we have learned quite a bit for ourselves and perhaps for our loved ones. I just talked with Eleanor and we shared some kind of almost the same thoughts about what we have heard from Sister Nuala. It's not just about what's going on with the legal staff and the hospital staff, but perhaps when we are going to appoint someone who may be responsible for our future, we'll also begin to re-engage our family relationship, perhaps kind of slightly, gently, re-evangelization means, you know, why we are choosing what we are choosing, and shouldn't be done in secret. Sometimes we will appoint someone and they'll be shocked that they have to decide something for us when situation occur. But when we begin, let's say today, we have a few years or maybe a few months, maybe more than a few years to talk about it, and sometimes family will question, okay, why my son or daughter may not be chosen to be my decision maker because thing is not I don't like them, I don't trust them. But there are some, in the future, tension that they can cause a division within the family. So when those information are quite gently shared, there is a lot of space, as we can see, to rebuild our community within the family. I think most of you can say, and some of you share with me, that most of your children, or our children, not mine, obviously, that I'm aware of, they are not going to the church. And, you know, most of us, or all of us, we don't have any more say to them. You must go, or make them feel guilty to do it. And I wouldn't advise to do it, because it simply will cause more grief and more division. But when we begin to talk about, you know, how you see me, you know, ending of life, and perhaps how you see how you may help me to make decision, that's influential about Jesus Christ and faith may be a kind of kindle into their life, into their thinking, and that's a good tool to re-engage our relationship, to perhaps listen them what they think and why they think what they think, you know. So again, thank you for being with us today, being together, and as our friend said, for pastoral care, and what Sister Nula mentioned, it, we just begin to do it, to see how we can engage not our families, but in Truro, there are lots of people who are lonely because their family live far away, sometimes in Halifax, and they don't want to come to face it, their family, or family members dying, or incapable to talk to them. So we are becoming the family. And also through that stage, we can share why it's so important to have this spirit, to have that faith, and to help those who are coming to the end to contain their dignity, human dignity, whatever the family members think about it. So those thoughts, perhaps we can take home and meditate and discuss, and maybe if you will be asked by Mike or Eleanor or me or somebody else, perhaps to join the group tomorrow or let's say next year, just maybe that would be the good thing to spread that movement into our new journey in the future. So thank you again. Have a lovely afternoon, and I will see you around.